It's very important to understand that coming into and out of World War I is a dramatic cultural awareness shift between things Germanic to French or Italian. And this is a country, by the way, you know, at the end of the Civil War and coming out of the Civil War, there were more newspapers at one point in America printed in German than in English. And there was a very famous vote in Congress in, I believe, the 1870s, early 70s, it might have even been earlier than that, there was a vote of whether German should become the intellectual academic language of America, and it failed by like one or two votes. So, I mean, this was a very serious issue and a very serious, what should I say, heartbeat of who we are as Americans. Multicultural without question, the Irish immigration without question, the Oriental influence of the 19th century is very much more of the workforce. Any Oriental themes or music elements that we're getting are completely tangential and fall into the folk things. It never became part and parcel. The American Indian and the African American are protected by essentially cult worshipers, but are not by any means embraced as music sources for the serious musician. That's still true after and before World War I, but this tectonic shift of Germanness to French or Italian or Latin, if you will, was demonstrable, palpable, and influenced expatriate musicians and artists demonstrably. Before World War I, they went to Paris to study, and they went to Russia, and certainly went to, the musicians went to Germany. They went to Leipzig. They went to Berlin. After World War I, because of the Germanness, I believe that travel was even forbidden, and the emphasis became much more for musicians French. That's where the Boulanger came up in the 20s and the 30s and so forth and so on. What is happening to American song at this point is there is an inward focus to writing literature that has a resonance to Americans living in America and now becoming known as Americans. There's no question about that. More importantly, I think, and this is where the show that we did called War Cries was based, and that is this idea that we use music to ramp up our courage to go to war, and we certainly use music to come home from war and lament the idiocy of and the loss and the useless loss of death of a soldier or of our brothers and sisters who then fought. War cries, it was the idea that we crying to go to war and cry because we've gone to war. And there was a lot of self-reflection of that and going into the 20s. The 20s, however, immediately took over this. It was a boom time. It was just an amazing amount of productivity. It was what they call the jazz age. Everybody was afoot. Everybody was creating more songs that you can possibly imagine, more poetry. Unfortunately, most of it, just after World War I and going into it, most of the songs, even based on poetry, and like in my, had a certain sentimentality to it. There was a certain, I don't know, hard on sleeve structure to it. So it takes a little while before we get our composers grappling again with the Langston Hughes of the world. Langston Hughes becomes Langston Hughes in the 20s. He's recognized like Walt Whitman first, outside of America, and Langston was much more in his German translations in Germany and Austria, a phenomenon before he became recognized for the prophet that he was in his own hometown. The civil disrest is huge. The birth of the NAACP, the National Association of Colored People, and of course that great towering intellect Dubois, or Du Bois as they know him in America, was huge. And there's a phenomenon that we didn't recognize at the time that actually in even our generation has become, how do we not celebrate this at the time? And it was celebrated in a mild way, but we're talking about two women, two African-American women, Florence Price and Margaret Bonds. And they wrote wonderful songs. Beautiful songs. And they were dear and deep friends and close friends of everybody from Langston Hughes to Kurt Weill and all the composers at the time. And even Aaron Copland. And in fact, Florence Price was the first, not just an African-American woman, but first a woman to have a symphony premiered by a major American orchestra in Chicago. And then she wrote this fantastic piano concerto. And what do you know? The first African-American soloist, Margaret Bonds, who is her protege, plays the piano for this. And this happens in the 30s. and is kind of a footnote to our musical history. And now we're recognizing it more and more for the tectonic shift and event that it actually was. This whole 30s and 40s and 50s, and actually to contemporary time, if I may just generalize, but I think in a positive way, is a world of African-American creativity that was not just neglected, it was reviled and it was prohibited. It was made fun of. You had glimpses of orchestra events of African-American composers that were extremely popular with the public and yet obviously politically pushed away and forgotten. And we're starting to revisit that in a major way. It's amazing that with all that happened in the 60s that we didn't revisit it even more and more dramatically than we have. But and I still, as strange as it seems in 2020 and my relationship with the African American Song Alliance and some wonderful African American colleagues that have, we've all banded together on this issue, it is amazing that it's such a hot topic still today and still an excavation, an exploration process of literature that was written 60 years ago of such demonstrative American character and such evidence of exactly what I believe song is, this evidence of the heartbeat through words and music. And so I'm very happy and proud to be part of that world today. And that was also a big part of Song of America. And in fact, my mission won't be complete until we stop referring to it as African American song. It is American song. And yes, it is fascinating and moving to me that it comes from my African-American cultural neighbors. But in fact, it's America. And America is made up of this multicolored, multiracial, deeply dedicated American passionate idealism. And it's these very qualities that have given the specialness to America that's been recognized in and outside of America. And it's these very qualities that are in such tremendous danger in the unbelievably short-sighted, utilitarian, banal, realpolitik that we are involved in today. And I love to say realpolitik because that was a phrase that we as Americans slammed down the Germans' throats and the English throats when we were being very suspicious of Mr. Hitler's politics. And the idealism of the German nature was so overwhelming, and yet we American politicians said, oh yes, we get your idealism, we're idealistic too, but realpolitik would tell us that this man is up to no good. And I would be very remiss if I did not offer that our literature, our songs, have absolutely been banners of evidence that realpolitik is part and parcel to what our song history is. And this is another reason why we must embrace and keep studying all of the what we've produced in various epochs of our very volatile and dramatic history in America. It's one of the things that fascinates me and keeps me going. But it is American song, not just Chinese American or African American or Indian American or Southwest America, American. You know, it's America. Welcome to America. And I hope that we see more of that in our day.